From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We like to think of ourselves as a rational species, and a lot of the time we can be. But when it comes to the way we see and treat animals, it's hard to find the logic. We see golden retrievers as cuddly, but salamanders are creepy. And while that makes complete sense to a lot of you, what's the difference really? Some animals we keep for companionship, others we kill and gut and grill and consume. A while back, the scholar Hal Herzog was considering how it was that 60% of Americans could believe simultaneously that animals have the right to live and that people have the right to eat them. A friend of his said the only consistency in the way humans think about animals is inconsistency. And so that's what his book is about, his way of explaining the paradox. Today in the program, Hal Herzog will join us. We hope you will too, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Hal Herzog had been studying animal behavior for years, and he was good at it. He was publishing his research in the good journals. He was getting his grant money. But at some point, it came to him that there really weren't that many people studying the way animals and humans interacted, that connection or that aversion, that relationship. So at some point, he shifted his study, began concentrating on a new discipline called anthrozoology. It's really about that study about that relationship, which we should say is often contradictory. We have a conflicted and sometimes nonsensical relationship with animals. Hal Herzog has written a book called Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. Boy, it's so hard to think straight about animals. And today in the program, he's joining us to talk about that relationship and those contradictions. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Hal Herzog is a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee, North Carolina. Specializes, as we said, in human-animal relations, written more than 100 articles and book chapters on the subject. And today he's joining us from WWCU at Western Carolina University. Hal Herzog, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Well, can we start with the time you were accused of feeding kittens to your son's boa constrictor?
Yeah, sure.
Because it seems to have really gotten you thinking about all of this. Let's start with that story, because it seems like that was when you started kind of getting at some of this.
It was. It was a turning point in my life in a way. I don't know how this happened, but we wound up. At one point, I was a snake psychologist. I had actually developed a personality test for baby snakes, and so we wound up, sort of a long story, with a baby boa constrictor for my son, Adam. And someone called me one day, a friend of mine who's an animal activist, and she said, "Hal, I just got word that you're going to the local animal shelter and getting kittens to feed your son's boa constrictor." And I said, "What? I would never do that. He's just a baby. He could never eat a kitten." And I told her, tell her friends no, or the kittens were safe. I was not doing that. That was just a crazy rumor. But the next couple of days, it began to haunt me, and I began to think, well, what I am feeding the snake was mice that are being raised just for the purpose of being snake food.
Right.
And through sort of a long, it just kept nagging me. Well, there are 3 million unwanted kittens in the United States that are being euthanized every year. Why shouldn't I feed kittens to boa constrictors? And one part of me was saying, no, this makes no sense at all. You would never do that. Oh, the idea is just horrible. But on the other hand, was saying, well, it would be more logical than feeding them mice that have to, that don't need to be killed. And that's what really got me thinking about how illogical our interactions with the animals are sometimes. It was so difficult for me to think logically about this issue.
Why is it? I mentioned in the introduction there that you'd been studying animal behavior for a long time, but you didn't really come to that connection between these relationships for a while. And you, as you said, there weren't that many people really trying to understand how people related to animals. And I guess the question is why? Why haven't we been studying this before? Is it because we don't like what we find when we think too deeply about all of this?
I think that's such a great question. I think there's a couple reasons, and I can speak best from my perspective in psychology. There's a psychologist, Paul Rosin, a great psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania, who argues that psychologists have really been interested in big sort of fundamental issues like learning and motivation and memory and things like that. And they've ignored aspects of everyday life that are so important to people, like food and religion. And I think our interactions with animals fall into this category of things that everyday people are really interested in. And they are really important in our lives, but the psychologists have largely ignored. Part of it, I think, has to do with thinking that our interactions with animals are trivial.
Yeah.
Even though if you ask people how important animals are in their life, they tell you they're tremendously important. Part of it has to do, I think, with this a deeper philosophical issue of is there a fundamental difference between them and us? And then what I found is when we start thinking about these issues, it can make people very uncomfortable.
Wasn't it Rosin who also said animals remind us of our mortality?
He did. He absolutely did. He said the reason why we get upset by certain things is that animals, we recognize that we are in some ways like animals, and they remind us that animals die and that therefore we can die. And a very, 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 very profound idea, I think.
So it seems as you're thinking about, okay, I think I want to study this. One of the things that must have been difficult to think about was, okay, it's not easy to measure a lot of this stuff. And some of it has to do with what you call these moral quandaries that we find ourselves in. Was it hard to make that leap? Because it's more abstract, this area of study, it seems.
Actually, it was not hard to make that leap. And at the time, I was very interested in measuring things. For example, I developed, as I think I mentioned, a snake personality
test. Right, of course.
Snake personality. So yeah. I was interested in numbers. But on the other hand, I was also interested in an ethnographic approach to research. And some of the first studies I did didn't involve numbers at all. They involved hanging out with people that had interesting relationships with animals and morally complicated interactions with animals. And the first group I studied were actually cockfighters, because I was living in an area where there was cockfighting going on. And some of my neighbors were cockfighters. And then basically it involved hanging out with these guys and going with them to illegal rooster fights and trying to understand how people that were so normal and conventional at one level had this deviant aspect of their life. You know, how can we make sense of that morality? And then the next group I studied, again, without numbers, was animal activists. And I began to do interview and hanging out with animal activists, going to animal rights demonstration and trying to find out what their world was like. So I have done stuff. I use really a two-pronged approach to my research. Mm. I do things that involve measurement, which, as you pointed out, is oftentimes really hard to do. And the other thing is I hang out with interesting people. Yeah. That's what I really like about my job.
Well, we're going to get to what you learned about the cockfighting part, which is a really interesting part of a chapter that comes later in the book. But let me ask you, so you were, as you said, you talked to animal rights activists and people who did these rooster fights, and you watched high school kids who were dissecting pigs, and you helped a farm crew slaughter cattle. So what is it that you think you want to know about that? I mean, what is the essence of that inquiry, do you think, for you?
That's such a great question. I think there's two things. One thing is I'm interested in human passions. And the reason I study human-animal interactions for different reasons than most people do. And I see these as a window into fundamental aspects of human nature, the best and the worst about what it means to be a human being.
Yeah.
And so by hanging out and trying to get a glimpse into this world of people that are so passionate about animals, whether they be purebred dog trainers or circus animal trainers or rooster fighters or even animal behaviorists, I think you get this window on human passion. Mm. And you also get a window in how everyday people try and construct a morally coherent world in situations which are very, very complicated.
Well, let's talk about where you are. I guess maybe this is the disclaimer part where you confess in the book you eat meat. You're not opposed to using mice, for example, to find cures for cancer and other diseases. But you don't eat veal. You don't want animals used to test perfume or eyeshadow. And I guess in that way you're like most of us, that we have these boundaries, I suppose, and they're not always entirely – they don't make complete sense if you were to sort of extend them out, and they're not always clear.
Yeah, my world doesn't make any more sense probably than the average person. And I think in a way – that's been my strength as a researcher.
Huh.
Is that there's a number of people in the field that are animal activists or are opposed to animal activism, and they take a hard view. And what I see myself as is the average person that has some tools, you know, because I'm a trained psychologist, that I can try and keep above the fray and try and look at these things objectively. And I've tried to portray the players on the various sides of this debate in an honest fair way, and I hope that I've succeeded in doing that.
But you're coming from that troubled middle, I guess.
I'm coming
right?
from the troubled middle, and I have my own moral conflicts, but they're not about meat. I've sort of made my peace with meat. I feel more morally conflicted about being a cat owner than I do about being a meat eater.
Wow. So this seems like such a crucial question before we even really dive in. So where do you see the place of humans in the scheme of things? Because I guess you also say that, look, let's be honest, at least this is how you see it, we're on a different moral plane than many of the other world's creatures.
Yeah, and here I have to I teach a course in biological psychology, and I tell students at the first day of class, I say, you know, the real theme of this class is what's the difference between you and your cat?
All right.
And that's what we're going to struggle with all semester.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's some years that I think that there's not much difference between me and my cat, and there's sometimes that there's years that go by that I think there's a vast difference between me and my cat. And right now, I think there's a vast difference between me and my cat. And to me, the difference more than anything else boils down to morality. Mm-hmm. And we see people like Mark Beckoff and Jonathan Balcom have shown that we see the rudiments of the moral sense in animals, other animals, non-human animals.
Right.
But I think humans have a moral burden that other animals don't have. And I think, to me, that does put us on a different moral plane. I'm not sure that does not give us the right to use them willy-nilly, for sure. But it gives us a moral burden that other species don't have. And I think that's not trivial.
Mm. You know, you write about in the book why it's important to look at all of this. One of the reasons is that, at least in the United States, a good part of us, two out of three, live with animals. We interact with animals on a regular basis. But you also say this. You say that our beliefs about how we should treat these other species are beginning to change. What are you seeing in the way we're thinking about animals that's evolving, that's changing?
It's really funny, and here's where you see the cultural schizophrenia more than any place else. And let's keep away from pets for a second and talk about economics.
Yeah.
So if you ask Professor Herzog, are we a nation of animal lovers? I would say, yeah, you know, we're a nation of animal lovers. But when you actually look at the math, you get a completely different view. So, for example, we spend about $3 billion a year, Americans do, on animal protection. That's the total donations to animal protection and environmental organizations. On the other hand, we spend something like, when you include the fish that we eat, we spend something like $200 billion on the animals that we kill and eat, and we spend about $75 billion on recreational hunting and fishing. So the bottom line is that, yeah, we're a nation of animal lovers, but we spend well over 100 times more on killing animals because they either taste good or it's fun than we do on protecting and loving them.
Wow.
And so I think we see here this cultural schizophrenia. Now, this is changing, but it's changing in some crazy ways too. So, for example, a lot of books will tell you that vegetarianism is really catching on in the United States, and there's more vegetarians than ever, and Americans are forsaking meat in large numbers. It's just not true. 97% of Americans eat meat. Two-thirds of self-proclaimed vegetarians eat meat. And the amount of meat that we, you know, Peter, in 1975, Peter Singer wrote his book, Animal Liberation.
Right.
And at that time, the average American ate 170 pounds of meat a year. And now we're up to 240 pounds of meat a year. So there is this cultural schizophrenia that I talk about. I think we see it more in our diet almost than any place else. So we're making changes. Like, so for example, I eat meat, but I try and buy meat that's cruelty free.
Right.
And it makes me feel better, but the animal's still dead.
When you say to someone, as you will from time to time, I'm sure you encounter people and they say, what do you do, Hal Herzog? And you say, I study human-animal relationships. How do people react to that? What do they say? Often they tell you about their dog or they tell you about their neighbor's dog or something.
That's absolutely what they say. And often, in fact, that's how I got a lot of material from my book. People would say, they'd say, what do you do? I say, well, I'm working on a book on human-animal relationships. They say, oh, you should talk to my, you know, Aunt Susie, or you should talk to my, my cousin. You know, he does this. And sometimes I would, and then I got some phenomenal stories.
So what do you make of that, though? What are they trying to say? They're trying to say this is the first line of interacting with an animal. It's what you do with your pet, right?
Yeah, it is. And pets are so important in people's lives. And this is something, if you go, there's not a single general psychology book or developmental psychology book or social psychology book that says anything about the human-pet interaction. Yet we spend $50 billion a year on our pets. We invite them into our homes. Most people think of their pets as full-fledged family members. And these relations are deep, oftentimes in profound, and also morally complicated.
Yeah, yeah. A terrific study that you write about, terrific just because it seems so strange, was this question of, you know, whether people actually do look like their dogs. I mean, you know, you see that and it's kind of a joke. It seems like a cliche. And when you heard about the study, you yourself were kind of skeptical that now it can't really be true. But I guess it is. We look like our pets.
Well,
dogs,
let me say, first of all, I did not do that study.
No, of course.
And the first people that did the study, I read about it, was in a very good journal. I just didn't believe it.
Right.
But subsequently, there's been three other studies that have found the same thing. And basically, this doesn't mean you look exactly like your dog. All these studies have basically taken the same approach. And what they do is they take pictures of people and they take pictures of the dog. And then they show pictures of the people and the dogs independently to external observers. And they say, can you match the people up? Can you match the people with their pets? And they can at a better than chance level. Yeah.
So, but the question is, what does that mean? Does that mean that we – because I want to get into this as you talk about these dynamics that come into play in how we treat animals, and that is – there's the cute factor, for example. The characteristics of a creature, how attractive we find them, are important in understanding how we relate to them.
It's absolutely critical. The example that I use in the book is I compare two endangered species that are both from Asia.
Yeah.
And one is the giant panda, you know, which is so endearing and so cute that the World Wildlife Fund uses it as its logo. Mm. And the other is an equally, I think, charismatic and interesting animal, the world's largest salamander, the giant Chinese salamander, which looks like a 6-foot-long, 150-pound bag of brown slime with little tiny beady eyes. Mm. And nobody cares about the giant Chinese salamander, even though it's the world's largest salamander. It's in some ways a more interesting creature. But the fact that creatures like the giant panda and baby seals, creatures like that, are so cute, they give them a moral status because they hook into our maternal and paternal instincts.
Yeah. It's the eyes. You mentioned in the book the eyes, that one of the biggest factors in how much money someone will spend when they donate to help an endangered species is the size of an animal's eyes.
Yeah, some researchers in Europe found that one of the biggest predictors of how much people would be willing to save an endangered species was how big its eyes were, how cute it is. Yeah.
And so you'd think that all of this would make some kind of logical sense. And we're going to talk about how this works on our biology, whether this is learned or whether this is something that's embedded in our genes. But in some ways, as you describe it, it's a quirk of human cognition. We think of ourselves as being rational. But is that the takeaway, that we're not really?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. At some level, you know, at one level, my book is about human-animal interactions. But in another level, it's, I think, I hope that it's deeper than that. And it's the issue that you're raising is that how people make moral decisions. And I think it used to be that psychologists thought that people were very logical in their moral decision-making. That is to say, you're confronted with a moral dilemma. What you do is you think about it logically, and then you make a decision, and then you do it. Mm. Well, the new school of psychology, of which I think is actually more accurate, is that moral decision-making is more like looking at a painting. So you go into a museum, and you see a painting, and you immediately know whether you like it or dislike it, whether you love it or hate it. And then you come up with a reason, so that if I ask you for a reason, you can come up with something. But the reasoning actually comes up after the decision. And I think a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times that plays into our moral decisions generally, including our interactions with animals. So we have these sort of what I call rival moral operating systems. Mm. You know, one is very rational and the other is gut level. And the question is, which is more important? And I think oftentimes it's that gut level, instinctive, instantaneous moral sense, intuition.
Yeah. It's the heart.
It's the heart.
Yeah. Hal Herzog is with us. He's the author of the book, Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. We invite you to join us with comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the conflicted and sometimes contradictory relationship that we have with animals. The psychology professor, Hal Herzog, is our guest. He's going to help us understand why we find some creatures so adorable and why some give us the creeps. The title of his book is Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. And we invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So I wanted to ask you about this question of being rational. So puppies are cute, and kittens are cute, and that makes sense to all of us. And snakes, they creep us out. And objectively, you say the fear doesn't really make much sense. There aren't that many people killed by snakes, for example, every year. So is it because there's some ancient aversion we have to snakes that's built into our genes, or is there something else? Because this gets at this question, you know, is this learned or is this innate? I mean, what is this fact that we freak out about snakes, so many of us, tell us about human nature?
Yeah, I think it tells us a lot about human nature. And it turns out, I hate to say it, but it's complicated.
Yeah.
One is that snakes are not much of a danger in the United States. There's a handful of people that could get killed by poisonous snakes. You're vastly more likely to get killed by your neighbor's dog than you are a poisonous snake in the United States. Mm. But yet, snakes are even the most common phobia in places like Maine, where I don't even think they have any poisonous snakes. You know, Ireland has no poisonous snakes, but yet, you know, snakes are the most common fear. On the other hand, snakes did represent a threat to our ancestors, and they still do represent a very real threat in Africa, Asia, and South America. So the question is, do we have an instinctive, you know, fear of snakes that we inherited from our ancestors? And what we seem to have inherited is maybe not so much a direct fear of snakes per se, but they had an instinct to pay attention to snake-like things and to very easily become afraid of them. And we know this from research that's been done at University of Virginia looking at infants. It turns out that if you put infants in front of a television monitor and you show them lots of different creatures, that they just glom onto the snake and they don't show a fear response, but they're very attracted to the snake and they pay attention to it and their heart rate changes and things like that, but they don't start crying. On the other hand, if they then see a person react really strongly to the snake, they will acquire that fear quite quickly. And monkeys have been found out to do the same thing. So we seem to be have an instinctive attraction to pay attention to them as a biological form. And then it's very easy to learn to be afraid of them. So it's a classic interaction between nature and nurture.
So if it's that complicated relationship, if some of this can be learned and some of it is instinctive, it raises the question of whether we can change our attitudes about animals. If it's so deeply held within us, a lot of these things, how do you unlearn some of this stuff? That seems to be part of the problem, I guess.
Yeah, well, it really is interesting. One of the things that I learned in writing this book is, in some ways, it changed my views about human nature. And I have become convinced that in some ways human behavior is more flexible than I thought that it had. Take, for example, the food that we eat.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, the idea of eating raw fish would have been absolutely horrifying. And now you can go to the smallest town in America and you can and sushi's popular.
Right.
The example I use in my book is a culture in Nepal. An anthropologist was studying a Nepalese village in which they had a religious taboo against eating buffalo.
Buffalo, right.
And they sacrificed buffalo, but they would never eat them. It was taboo to eat them. And this guy came back 10 years later, and he's sitting around with his pals, playing cards and drinking beer. And they said, hey, you want to have some buffalo? Hmm. He said, what? You guys don't eat buffalo? And in 10 years, they had changed their mind about buffalo.
Right.
They made a fundamental change in their eating. And it was because the culture had become sort of more democratic. They had had more interaction with the outside world. The price of other foods became higher, and buffalo meat was cheap, and they changed a tabooed food in a matter of ten years. And I think now we're seeing changes in our attitudes towards animals. We have, to the benefit of the pet industry, we've elevated pets to a degree which is, I think, unprecedented in American culture, in terms of treating them like children. So I think attitudes can change. On the other hand, our attitudes towards meat at some levels have changed, but yet in some ways it's been very difficult to get massive numbers of people to completely give up meat.
Names and language is important here. And the names we give animals, but also the words we use to describe them. You talk about how language helps us create actually our perception of reality. And there's this case, for example, the Chilean sea bass. It didn't really catch on as this delicious fish until someone changed its name from, what was it, the Patagonian toothfish?
The Patagonian toothfish.
Yeah.
And apparently it's a nightmarish-looking creature.
Right.
Big bulgy eyes, not cute eyes, but big bulgy eyes and needle-sharp teeth. And it was a trash fish. Mm. And this guy that was a fish who had a fish company in California said, well, what's that stuff you guys are all throwing away? They said, oh, people don't want that stuff. And he tasted it, and he said, it was sort of mild. And he thought, this is something chefs might like because they can sort of modify the taste pretty easily. But this name, Patagonian toothfish, isn't going to work. So we need to rename it. So they renamed it the Chilean sea bass, and the rest is history.
Words we use for meat, for example, you talk about how that kind of helps us avoid thinking about all these ethical implications about it. You get a pound of beef, you don't get a pound of cow.
Right.
So we're avoiding having to have to always confront those ethical dilemmas, even though they're always there in the supermarket.
That's right. And the other thing that's happened with that is that the meat industry has changed the way that we buy meat.
Right.
So it used to be that, let's take chicken, for example. It used to be that most chickens sold in stores in the United States, grocery stores, were sold as carcasses. Now less than 10%.
And by that you mean it had all the parts in there, right?
Yeah, it had all the parts. In other words, it was dressed and everything, but you bought it. It had a leg and legs and thighs and breast and stuff, and you would take it home and you would cut it up.
Yeah.
Well, if you're dismembering a carcass, a body, it's hard to avoid the animality of that creature. Well, now people don't buy chicken like that anymore. Chicken has become this dismembered thing. We have parts that we give really odd names to, chicken fingers or chicken tenders.
Right.
And it comes in little styrofoam packages, and it looks almost like a piece of plastic. So we don't have to think that it was a creature, that it had blood. It's very bloodless. And I know, my wife, for example, she won't cut up a chicken carcass. I will, but she's too grossed out by it.
But she likes chicken.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There's the contradiction, right? 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Jeremy is with us. He's in Ogden, Utah. Jeremy, welcome.
Hey there.
Hi.
Hey, I have a little question I'd like to ask, and I thought the author might have a good take on this. I'm actually going to be a hunter for the first time this fall, and I've run across a lot of friends that I tell that to, and these aren't vegetarians by any means and stuff, but they kind of have a moral problem with me going out and hunting deer, whereas apparently they don't have much of an issue with, you know, killing other animals, cows, chickens, etc. So I was just wondering what your take was on that.
It's a dicey connection we have there. Hal Herzog, could you hear what he was getting at?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, it would be really interesting for me. I like interviewing people like you because it'd be great to, once you do that, you go out and let's say you're fortunate and you out kill a deer. It'd be interesting to know what your response to that actually is. I know animal activists who argue that if you're going to eat meat, it's morally superior to actually go out and kill it yourself. And not because of the killing yourself, because that animal actually had a pretty good life, a better life than the cow raised on a feedlot. So you can sort of throw that back at them. And here we also have this other problem, is that hunting is this American tradition. And in fact, a couple of years ago, President Obama declared September National Hunting and Fishing Month. And he encouraged Americans to take their kids out hunting and fishing. Now, the fact is, however, you can't deny it. Hunting is it's the intentional death of an animal. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, sometimes these animals die quickly, but oftentimes they don't. It's estimated that a third of the birds that are shot out of the sky end up flopping around on the ground for quite a while. And sometimes, that they're never actually found. So they basically die a pretty lousy death. So, I think hunting does pose a moral problem, but we have the cruelties that we condemn, and we have the cruelties we condone. And for most of American culture, hunting is a time-honored tradition. Although most people don't do it anymore, it's only a very small proportion of Americans that actually hunt anymore. I think it's less than 10%.
Is it because of the moral quandaries we have with it? Is that one of the reasons?
I think that's probably one of the reasons, but I think probably the more important reason is urbanization.
Sure.
Yeah. I think that's probably a bigger reason, and because we've changed our diet surprisingly little, in terms of the amount of meat that we eat. So, Sarah Palin, of course, used her hunting, presumed hunting skills as a, political campaign.
Absolutely. Well, it still works for a lot of politicians.
Yeah.
Jeremy, glad you called. Thanks very much. Back to
it's a great good luck with that.
Yeah.
Send me an email and tell me what it was like.
Let's see. Chris is with us in Orem, Utah. Chris, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. I appreciate the show. I'm actually the founder of something called Mormons for Animals, and I've taught animal ethics at UVU, and we sometimes show videos of how animals are treated in factory farms, et cetera. My experience is that most people's gut-level ethics actually agree with their rational ethics if they have to actually watch how factory farm animals are abused and, treated for most of their lives and then slaughtered. And therefore, my question is, and my view is that people, like I said, if they have to actually see where it comes from, then they feel that it's wrong and that it should be different, et cetera, and think that it should be wrong. Therefore, do you agree that people's lifestyles actually are just in contradiction to their ethics, at least in those cases? And furthermore, that they sort of get by not rationally justifying themselves, but just by sort of not listening or not wanting to see it, or what I call ignorance, which is they just don't want to know what happened to the animal. That's sort of my view about people's lifestyle versus their ethics when it comes to animals. What do you think of that?
So, Hal Herzog, what do you think? I mean, so this idea, I guess, that if people were honest about it all, if they were to confront the reality, that there wouldn't be such a disconnect between reason and emotion. What do you think?
Yeah, I thought about this a lot, and I think that we disagree about this, and this is where I think we disagree. I've got a lot of friends that are animal activists, and I like animal activists, and I admire them tremendously because they have the moral courage to make these changes in their life. They have the guts, the fortitude to make really big changes in their life because of morality. Most people don't. And a lot of my friends tell me that if people only knew about the horrors of factory farming, that they would change. Well, I don't think that's true. Paul McCartney once said if slaughterhouses had glass walls, everybody would be a vegetarian. I don't think that's true. I'm amazed at – I think you're absolutely right about the disconnect between people's beliefs and their behavior. I think that's what my book's about, basically. What if I were, let's say the Humane Society, Wayne Pacelli were to call me up and say, Hal, what can we do to get people to stop eating meat? I would say you need to approach their hearts, not their head, and what you need to do is to make meat disgusting. So, for example, I quit eating hamburger after I read Eric Schlosser's book on factory farming,
right.
but it wasn't because of the cruelty to animals. It was that I did not like the idea of eating a piece of meat that had hundreds and hundreds of cattle in it, some of which had been sick and all of which had been raised the last weeks of their life standing in feces. The hamburger simply became disgusting to me,
right.
and I quit eating it. And so I think what the animal activists ought to do is make meat more disgusting. I think that appealing to the head when it comes to food has not been very successful for the movement. Given the fact that the argument against meat, I agree with your caller about one thing, I'm sure. The argument against meat is really, really strong. There's almost no reason, logical reason, for eating meat except that it tastes good. There's lots of reasons why we shouldn't do it. But yet still, 97% of Americans eat meat. And, to me, that's where the rubber meets the road when it comes to animal ethics. It's this mismatch over meat.
But what does that say about us, Hal Herzog, that we can sort of look the other way in terms of the way animals are treated, but when it may be disgusting and it may affect, my appetite, that'll change my mind?
My guess is that it probably has something to do with health.
Yeah. Is that a kind of evolutionary sort of?
Yeah, I think so. One of the things that's interesting, if you look at the success of two social movements, the campaign to moralize, by moralize I mean make something immoral.
Yeah.
If you look at the campaign to moralize cigarette smoking, it's been really amazingly successful given how addictive cigarettes are. But the campaign to moralize meat has been spectacularly unsuccessful. And meat, if anything, is more addictive than cigarettes. And I'm amazed at how unsuccessful the animal rights movement has been, given the power of the argument against meat. And I think it's because they've been, people know that that the animals are treated cruelly. One thing the animal activists have done is that they've said, all right, what we'll do is we'll make it less cruel. So what I do is I buy supposedly cruelty-free chicken and stuff like that. It makes me still feel okay about it. And I have the illusion that this stuff is cruelty, free range and all that. But I know I know in my heart it's an illusion. Hmm. So if anything, the animal rights movement has made it more palatable to eat meat by this idea of we can have cruelty-free meat.
Hal Herzog is with us. He's the author of the book Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. Why it's so hard to think straight about animals. We should say it just came out in paperback today. Chris, thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Hal Herzog. We're talking about his book, Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back to the phones. David is with us now in Salt Lake. David, hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a comment that I'd like to make. I grew up in a rural community, and my family and I we raised our own meat, slaughtered our own meat, and it wasn't until in my teenage years that we actually went to the store and I found out that you could buy white eggs instead of having brown eggs and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
My comment is, because of my upbringing and seeing how animals, by their nature, work, for instance, with chickens, I raised chickens for many years. They oftentimes, when they go to peck for the scratching grain on the ground, will miss and consume their fecal matter. And so I find it somewhat interesting that there's sort of that movement in today's society that people are moving towards these free-range eggs and free-range chickens rather than having one that's kept in a coop and fed grains. And so I think it's interesting that people are willing to eat eggs and chickens that are probably more open to eating their own waste rather than going through the commercial way of producing chickens.
Hmm. David Gletschkoff, thanks very much.
By the way, thanks for telling me that. Now I'm going to have to worry about eating free-range chickens.
Well, I don't want to get into the question of whether or not free-range chickens are more contaminated than the others. I mean, it's a good I'm glad you called, and it's a good perspective. Let me shift gears a little bit, though, in terms of this idea of that conflict between emotion and reason and sort of take this a little further, as you do in the book. There's this story that comes, this really disturbing story from 1977, and you tell it to kind of illustrate all of this. The central character is this huge, immense crocodile named Cookie. And it raises a really difficult question here. Tell the story, if you would, because I want to talk about this.
Yeah, it's a very sad story. And I was actually, because I was a reptile behaviorist at the time, I was actually doing research down in Florida when this happened. Cookie was a crocodile, I believe he's a Nile crocodile, in the Miami Serpentarium, and had been there for years and years, and was, I think, something like 14 feet long, and spent his day doing what crocodiles do, which is just lay around and do nothing in the sunshine. And this man had his young son, and they were looking at Cookie, and Cookie wasn't doing anything, and he wanted to show his son that, you know, crocodiles do move, so he put his son up on the concrete wall that was in Cookie's enclosure, and he reached down to get, I think it was something like a little nut or something on the ground that he was going to toss at Cookie to make Cookie move, and what happened was his son fell in. Well, it was exactly the spot where Cookie was normally fed. So Cookie suddenly transforms into this thing that looks like a statue to this, you know, crocodiles move like lightning when they want to. He grabs the child and drags him to the bottom of the pond and kills him.
Yeah.
And William Haast, the guy that was the owner of the Serpentarium, was, of course, horrified. And this happened, of course, in front of a bunch of tourists. And it was a tragedy by all concerned. And that night, Haast woke up in the middle of the night. He got a pistol, a Luger, and he put 9 bullets in Cookie's brain. And there, of course, you know, a crocodile, of all creatures, a crocodile is not a moral agent. And so I raised the question, why should Cookie have died?
Well, Cookie was doing what he was naturally inclined to do.
Cookie did everything.
He has the brain the size of your thumb, as you point out.
Yeah, he's got this tiny brain. And the New York Times actually had an editorial at the time. And I think the editorial said somebody, they asked an interesting question. They said this made no logical sense, but it just felt like the right thing to do. And so I use it to introduce the idea of legal scholar Cass Sunstein has called moral heuristics. And a heuristic is sort of a mental shortcut. And we use it all the time in our life to do crossword puzzles, to hospital emergency rooms. But a moral heuristic is a quick and dirty rule of thumb that provides moral guidance. And in this case, the moral heuristic was revenge. And it made no logical sense, but yet, That's the way we work. There was a similar case that I didn't use where in 1910, an elephant was going through the town of Irwin, Tennessee, not far from where I live. and killed its trainer, and they sentenced him to death, and they hung him to death.
Wow.
Publicly. They had a public hanging of this giant elephant, Murderous Mary. There's a picture of it you can see.
So here's your heart and your head. On one hand, killing the animal makes no sense. But there is another part of you that you write about that seemed to kind of understand in some way the need for retribution.
Totally.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. I mean, yeah.
You talk about in the book this debate over, you know, whether morality is based on reason or emotion, and it goes back a long time. And you've investigated how people make these decisions about using animals in research, which is a good part of the book. What did you learn about the boundaries that people have for using animals? Here again, I guess we use gut more than reason?
In some ways we do. So, for example, you asked before about attitudes changing.
Yeah.
And this is one of the areas where attitudes have changed. More people in the United States, some recent polls have shown more people are opposed to animal research aimed at saving lives than are opposed to hunting. So Americans approve of killing animals for recreation more than they approve of using animals in research. But it really depends on the type of research. In some ways, people are logical. People are more likely to approve of research which is going to be applied to some, you know, specific disease. They're less likely to, you know, to want to use things like chimpanzees in research than they are rats. But scientists have their own problems with this too. And one of the number studies that I did do with the social psychologist named Scott Plowse is we looked at how valid and how consistent decisions were of animal care and use committees are. And these are the committees that decide whether or not a study gets done at a university. And so what we did was we got a grant from the National Science Foundation, and they let us have, we sent proposals that had been gone through the review process at one university. We sent it to a second university to see if they would make the same decisions. And we did this for 150 proposals. And I was shocked to find how inconsistent these committees were. So these are trained scientists who really know these research areas, but when asked, should this research be done or should it be modified, there was an amazing amount of inconsistency even among scientists who people trained to use their heads.
Here's an email from Doug, who writes from Cambridge, Mass. Eating meat has nothing to do with the animals, he writes. It has to do with eating something that tastes good, makes you feel satisfied, and is convenient. Vegetables, he writes, often don't meet any of those requirements. So I guess this is where I thought David was going. This question that, look, we're carnivores. We're animals too. That's a powerful part of human nature as well. Where does that play into all of this?
I think it plays a tremendous role, and I agree with your email writer. I think I'm a meat eater, and not everybody does, but I find that the taste of a perfectly prepared piece of meat, the right kind, and I'm particularly fond of pork right now, is a very profound pleasure. However, that doesn't make it moral. And I think we have inherited this. You know, we evolved from meat-eating apes, and most anthropologists believe that the shift to eating more meat was very important in the evolution of the human brain. The problem is that because we have a big brain and because we have a different level of morality than other animals do, that doesn't make it moral. Just because something tastes good doesn't mean it's okay to kill it and eat it.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the problem that we're confronted with. It's philosophers call this the naturalistic fallacy. Just because something is natural does not make it morally right.
One thing you write about in the book is the different impressions, different cultures, the two genders see all of this. If we have some time, I want to talk a bit about that. But let's talk about culture a little bit, how that plays into how we think about all of this. You talk about this socio-zoological scale coined by a zoologist, Arnold Arluck, I think is his name. Americans see creepy, crawly things as creepy. In Japan, one example, it's more complicated than that. So, in other words, we're not all seeing things in the same way. Culture plays a role.
Absolutely. And where you see that best is in, I think, dog eating.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, for us, dog eating is horrifying. But yet in Asia, in parts of Asia, dogs are a fairly regular part of the diet. They in South Korea, for example, they actually divide dogs into different types of categories, and they actually sell them in the same markets. And there's pet dogs, and there's meat dogs, and they call the meat dog a different name. They have a separate name for them. They keep them in different color cages, and they actually look different. They look surprisingly like Old Yeller, by the way, unfortunately.
Wow.
But those are the meat dogs. And at the same places, right across from these meat dog stalls, that they will sell pet dogs. And so I think you know, when you say, would you eat? Is it okay to eat the family dog? In the United States, you know, everybody would say no. But yet, dog eating is common and has been common in many human cultures. Absolutely. Another thing about culture, by the way, is that pet keeping is not a cultural universal.
Yeah. Saudi Arabia, you talk about how dogs are just despised, and it's our behavior is strange in other places, of course.
Yeah, take for the example, one of the examples I use in the book is Sri Lanka, you know, the island of Sri Lanka. And if you're Buddhist in Sri Lanka, the chances of you having a pet in your house is 85%. A pet dog is 85%. On the other hand, if you're a Muslim in Sri Lanka, it's less than 5%.
Hmm.
So the way we did this is, I think, a good example that the sociozoological scale that Arnie talks about.
30 seconds. We're almost out of time. Let me ask you this whole finally. You talk about the intent of the book. You don't want people to change their minds necessarily, but you just want them to think more deeply about it all.
That's exactly right. I wrote a book. I'm troubled by many of these issues myself, but I think it's a healthy thing for people to think about the morality in their lives, especially with related to other animals, and that was really my goal, was to write a book that was entertaining and yet intellectually challenging and get people to think.
Hal Herzog, his book "Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat: Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals." Thanks very much for the time.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.